You're listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Let me start by welcoming you all here today on behalf of the Regional Policy Initiative on Afghanistan and Pakistan and the Open Society Foundation. My name is Faisal Bari. I work as senior advisor here with OSF on Pakistan. The topic that we have is fairly broad, managing risks, securing interests, and expressing values. But we do have two wonderful speakers who are obviously have dealt with these issues for a long time now, so we'll look forward to a very interesting discussion. Ahmed Rashid is very well known to all of us, starting from his writings in various newspapers, whether it be Telegraph or the Washington Post or the New York Review of Books. And then, of course, the book Taliban, and then Descent into Chaos, among other books. And finally, most recently, actually, Pakistan on the Brink, which will set up some of the discussion for today, I think. And Ambassador Umar Samad. Ambassador Samad was with the Foreign Ministry of Afghanistan since 2001, first as spokesman for the Foreign Ministry, then he was ambassador to Canada from 2004 to 2009, and then ambassador to France till end of 2011. Is currently the Afghanistan senior expert in residence with Center for Conflict Management at the United States Institute of Peace. So let me just start by framing what, so we'll have each speaker, we'll request them to speak for about 20 minutes, and then we'll open up the floor for comments, discussion, and questions. Basically, the thinking was that there's a lot happening in the parts of the world that we're going to talk about, and not just in Pakistan and Afghanistan, and not looking at just the very recent events, but also obviously across the entire MENA region, Middle East, North Africa. And I'm not here referring, as I said, to the last events of the last few days, but generally the last few, a couple of years, basically. And I think there are significant links that we can think about across all of the things that are happening. There are tremendous governance challenges in these countries, challenges of democracy, challenges of rule of law, transitions, and governance structures. Economic challenges, massive across almost the entire region, some countries much more tougher than others, but nonetheless very significant economic challenges. Just giving one example, Pakistan is going through an energy crisis right now where we don't get electricity sometimes for 10, sometimes 16 hours a day. Institution building, again, across the entire region as the transitions happen, as challenges happen to power. And then, of course, one of the bigger challenges of ideology. I mean, what sort of, not just from the extreme right, but across the sort of political platform, but most significantly, obviously, from the extreme right. There are tremendous negotiations that are happening in each of these societies, renegotiations, and that need to happen as well within the societies as well. And at the same time, the question that arises is what should be the role of international community, the US, the West, whatever we want to, however we want to look at this notion of international community, in some or all of these transitions, giving obviously due credence and respect to the domestic negotiations that are going on. And do we still think in terms of military aid and diplomacy as the three pillars usually used, or are we looking at thinking about new conceptual frameworks for talking about how to look at these countries in transition and maybe some other countries also? Do we still use the frameworks of war on terror, regime support, and so on, or are there other ways of thinking about what needs to happen in these countries? Is there a new paradigm? Are there lessons from nation building that we can sort of latch on to? And then, of course, moving from these broader concerns, given the expertise of the two speakers, we will obviously see how these concerns play in the exact particularities of Pakistan and Afghanistan in the discussion that comes. So let me, with this request, M. Rashid Saab to start and give us his thoughts, and then we'll request Ambassador Samad.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Faisal. It's a great pleasure to be here, and thank you all for coming. And I've had a very long association with OSI, as many of you know. And, you know, first let me just acknowledge, I'm sorry that Dr. Alexis Cross, who was supposed to be, Crow, who was supposed to be here from Chatham House, is not here. And I just want to acknowledge that some of the ideas I'll be talking about are originally hers rather than mine. I really want us to, you know, I've been deeply worried in the last 6 months or so, living in Pakistan, seeing what's happening in Afghanistan, seeing the recent events in the Middle East, and really thinking very seriously about the failures of the Western intervention in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and what is the cause of this. The first thing is that, you know, we're dealing right now with multiplying failing or failed states. If we look at, you know, Yemen, Somalia, Mali, you know, and you know, God forbid that one of the North African states becomes a failing or failed states after having got rid of their dictators. We're looking at enormously complex internal conflicts and civil wars and insurgencies. Pakistan is beset by a fundamentalist Islamic Taliban insurgency in the northwest, and it's beset by an insurgency in Balochistan, which is secular, tribal, and a movement for separation and breaking up of the country. Now, you know, how do you tackle these two extreme insurgencies? And there is an incredibly widespread loss of confidence in the West, particularly in the American, in the United States, and in NATO and in Europe. We saw that in Iraq. We've seen that to a larger extent even now in Afghanistan and in Pakistan. And probably this is what we're also seeing in North Africa. Yes, there are fundamentalists who are anti-American and who are spreading the message, and there are state intelligence agencies like in Pakistan who promote anti-Americanism as a part of state policy. But there's also a loss, a very, I think, legitimate loss of respect, and that the West has really failed to deal with the issues, you know, over the last 10 years that particularly have affected the Muslim world. If you look at the financial system is, your own financial system is now beset with corruption, with money laundering, with this whole LIBOR scandal. The banks, the financial houses, the investment houses are being seriously questioned by the West itself. So how do you expect people to react in the third world, where they expect these financial institutions to help them or save them, as it were, or to rebuild their economies? So I see three major failures, and I would really like some serious people to really, people like the Soros Foundation to really seriously really think about. The first is that we have utterly failed to build sustainable economies in insurgency-hit countries or failing states. After 12 years in Afghanistan and billions of dollars, we do not have a sustainable economy in Afghanistan. Iraq is only saved. Iraq was, you know, awash with incompetence and wastage and corruption for many years until the oil production started. And how the West is going to tackle building a sustainable economy in Yemen or in Somalia, if this government takes root, or in Egypt, is going to be a major problem. And essentially, the Western model of these huge behemoth agencies like AID and DFID of Britain and these state-run aid agencies, cutting huge checks to give out to contractors and to give out to the NGOs, this model is now utterly failed. And I don't think that this model really is of all what we are seeing, what the think tanks and what other people in Washington and London are doing, is tinkering around trying to improve this model somehow, or make it more efficient, or make it more competent, or make it more accountable. But essentially, the model has failed. This is not the way to build a sustainable economy. And I think, you know, very serious thinking has to be done by the major Western powers who have an interest in, you know, stability and all the rest of it, and helping these countries emerge. If we're going to use this model in Egypt, for example, you know, pour money down the drain, a lot of wastage, etc., repeat the models of Afghanistan and Iraq, I think we are headed for failure. So the model here, I think, that we have to think of is much more usage of the private sector, Western private sector involvement in trying to create a new entrepreneurial class in these insurgency-hit countries. I don't think governments and aid agencies and NGOs can do this. This has to be done on a for-profit, if you like, motive by the Western private sector. Now, how, you know, the question arises, are you going to get the Lehman Brothers and, you know, Citibank to invest in insurgency hit here? How do you get them to invest in Pakistan or in Afghanistan or in Mali or somewhere else like that? And I think this is something that needs to be done and needs to be addressed by experts who can find a way. One way that certainly I have is that a lot of these banks and investment houses give enormous funding for charity. I think some of that money could be set aside for high-risk investment in a for-profit basis in some of these countries. Pakistan, for example, has an enormous private educational system which is crying out for investment. And it is the private sector and education, for example, which is profitable, which is, you know, economically viable, and which could deliver get financial help from Western banks and investment houses, and also produce a profit. And I'm sure there are examples in Afghanistan and other places for that. The second issue, I think, which really needs to be rethought, is the need for a cultural dialogue. There is, if you just look, Afghan soldiers trained by Americans are killing their American mentors. And on the other side, you have U.S. soldiers urinating on dead bodies and ripping up and burning Qurans. Now, 12 years after, some of these American soldiers have done 2-3 tours of duty, the cultural gap is not reduced, it is actually growing. And these incidents are, you know, they can be a reflection of frustration and the loss of, you know, paranoia and all these things. But it also reflects a huge cultural gap between the West and the Muslim world, or rather the West and how to deal with these failing states. A lot of these failing states are, you know, immensely complex places with tribes and cultures and religions that have to be understood. Now, certainly there have been parts of the U.S. government which have made huge efforts to try and understand it. But the fact that you're still sending soldiers out there who don't know how to behave in a Muslim society, for example, you're training Afghans who are not able to cope with the cultural shock of working with Americans. Now, that means that, you know, we have a huge culture. And part of the tragedy is that, you know, General Petraeus, his whole counterinsurgency strategy, just did not seem to take in a cultural dialogue. You know, the new counterinsurgency strategy is all about being for the people, and we isolate the guerrillas, and we help the people and support the people. But this whole aspect of cultural dialogue seems to be utterly missing. And I think substantial thought needs to be given in that. The third thing is mediation. Now, here too, what we're seeing is the behemoths of government, the State Department, the British Foreign Office, NATO, all of these organizations who have been trying to mediate, whether it was in Iraq between Sunni and Shias or Kurds, whether it was in Afghanistan between the Taliban and the government, or the northern, the non-Pashtuns and the Pashtuns, these institutions have failed. And they are not capable of doing mediation. I've been watching this whole Taliban talk thing for the last year and a half, and I'm so utterly depressed at the incompetence of Western so-called mediators, because there is no cultural understanding. There is no expertise. There is no knowledge of the countries they're dealing with. Look, we are past the era now where we can expect that, you know, some grand conference, Balkan-like conference will emerge and everybody will be forced by the might of U.S. military power to sit down at the table and sign the document for peace. Or that we're ever going to see that again, or that we're going to see, you know, the Japanese surrender to General McCarthy. We're not going to see wars end this way. We're going to see wars end through mediation. and through dialogue and through coming to an understanding with each other. And frankly, governments today in the West are not capable of doing this. Much better, in my opinion, are are some of the NGOs, some of the think tanks, some of the private sector organizations. The Red Cross is able to have a dialogue with the Taliban. Now, what secret has the Red Cross got that they can have a dialogue and treat the wounded of the Taliban in the midst of a civil war? The Swedish Committee of Afghanistan runs, 300 schools in Taliban-controlled areas and has been able to keep open those schools for girls. Now, through a constant dialogue, why can't governments learn something from the way private sector is approaching the issue of trying to have a dialogue with the so-called enemy and trying to keep, economies and education and all the rest of it running? So mediation, to my mind, is absolutely essential. And I think it is time that governments started supporting private sector mediation. And by private sector mediation, I don't mean that every Tom, Dick, and Harry can get up and start mediating. I mean, obviously, we have to have respectable think tanks, NGOs, whatever, even groups of people, groups of intellectuals who can come together and try and attempt mediation, either at the local level or at a national level. So I think, the key to ending these conflicts is going to be mediation. And I think these governments and foreign offices and state departments have to understand that they are no longer in a position to push these. They have to support the private sector. They have to offer the facilities, services, security, ideas, what their interests are, what they want out of this mediated settlement. Certainly, they have to support it, but I don't think that they're in a position to. So these three items, building a sustainable economy, a cultural dialogue, and mediation, I think these are crucial to having any kind of settlement, in Afghanistan, Iraq, or the next, crisis that we're going to face, whether it's in the Arab world or in Africa. So I'm essentially saying we have run out of ideas, and it's time that we really started looking afresh with new ideas and with new eyes at these problems, rather than tinkering around on the periphery and trying to revamp these old institutions. How long have I got? Let me just spend. Okay, having given you all that sort of thing, I mean, I really feel very emotional about this because I've been in this business for 35 years, and I push this peace process and that peace process, and nothing is working, and nothing seems to work. And I don't want to end my life in total failure. I would like to see people now really get to grips with some of these problems. Now, let me just briefly touch on Afghanistan. I think we have four or five major problems, an internal crisis and an external crisis. And I think there is still time where some of these issues can be tackled before the American withdrawal. The first is the issue of a failure to establish an Afghan economy. There is no Afghan economy at the moment that is really job creating and is going to provide jobs for the thousands of Afghans, by the way, who are going to be released from servicing the foreign troops. And these are the key, these are educated, English-speaking, democracy-loving Afghans who are part of the new post 9/11 generation, and they're really going to be rendered jobless at a mass level. And we don't have a sustainable economy to absorb the refugees who will be pushed back into Afghanistan from Iran and Pakistan, etc. And I'm not saying that in 18 months we can build an economy from scratch, but certainly the wastage, the corruption of the money on both the American side and the Afghan side has been chronic. And the same, of course, goes for Iraq. And the same is likely, what we could well see tomorrow in Egypt or in Yemen if U.S. money follows the same track model and if NATO money and European money follows the same track model. The second thing, which I hope Omar will talk in more detail, is the potential political crisis in the country. Presidential elections in 2014, will Karzai step down, won't he? How will these elections take place? How will the dialogue with the Taliban continue? How will the non-Pashtuns react to the Pashtuns with the growing ethnic tensions, rising ethnic tensions in the country? There is a very severe political crisis in which, again, governments, particularly the US government, has done very little work, at least in the public arena. There doesn't seem to be very much. It's all about transition and, you know, troops moving here and moving there, and we're not really hearing about these political problems. The third really internal problem is the state of the army. The statistics about the Afghan army and the police force are still very, very poor. 90% illiteracy, 20% desertions, and this massive recruitment of Pashtuns in very short notice, which has obviously allowed Taliban sympathizers to come into the ranks. No clear idea how effective the army is going to be able to take control of even security. But the key to this, of course, is that if the Americans leave Afghanistan in a present state of civil war without a political settlement with the Taliban, to expect this Afghan army to stand up and fight a civil war with the Taliban is, I think, beyond hope and expectation. Fourthly, the talks with the Taliban. They've been stranded, they've been, you know, paralyzed for the last 9 months, and now, of course, they will be until this election in America is over and the new government, the new administration comes in probably in January. I hope they will be revived. And two external factors, which are essential again, on which very little work has been done. One is the issue of Pakistan. There is no question that a peace in Afghanistan cannot be achieved as long as Pakistan continues to harbor the major leadership of the Taliban and tens of thousands of fighters and the logistics of the Taliban war in Afghanistan. Secondly is a broader external settlement. This administration tried, I think, during Richard Holbrooke's time for a broader settlement, but we are not seeing the continuation of that. And in fact, if you look at the situation now in the region compared to Holbrooke's time, I mean, the Americans now obviously have no relations with Iran, and you know, Israel may bomb Iran, and God knows what that would do to Iran's a role in Afghanistan. It would try and destabilize U.S. forces in Afghanistan, etc. The Americans have a pitiful dialogue with Pakistan right now and a very, very tense relationship. President Putin is blowing hot and cold towards the United States. We're not certain what his policy is going to be towards the withdrawal and all the rest of it, even though there is some cooperation by the Russians in allowing U.S. Troops and all to use the northern corridor. But generally speaking, the regional situation is much worse now than it was 2 years ago. And we may be facing another war on the horizon in Iran. So, and these are issues that really need to be tackled on an emergency basis, both external issues and internal issues. And clearly, if the Americans think that they can just slip out of Afghanistan without addressing some of these issues, we are going to see then some of these neighboring states biding their time, not so much the Taliban, but the neighboring states, biding their time, waiting till 2014, waiting for the Americans to leave, and then they will play their cards inside Afghanistan. And we could face a really multi-dimensional civil war fueled by neighboring states using their proxies, as they did in the 1990s, which, of course, would be immensely destabilizing for everyone because it would allow extremists and terrorists to come back into Afghanistan. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I just want to say that, Ahmed, you're not a failure. You've done very well, and you're continuing to do well and write well and analyze well. I think you've been a strong and important voice since the 1990s in regards to Afghanistan, Pakistan, Central Asia, and the region. And I am of the pre-9/11 generation and post-9/11 generation. I remember distinctly the Afghanistan of the 1960s and 70s, coming from a political and diplomatic family, know to the extent possible what we underwent in previous generations and then what happened to us as of 1978 and beyond, and how many different phases of turmoil and instability this country and this nation has seen. A country that at one time was stable, was peaceful, was actually developing in some fashion or another, but moving forward. And so if you look at the Afghanistan history, it's not a country, as some people would like us to believe, where it was all tribal warfare, ethnic warfare, religious warfare, or anything like that. It was a country that had undergone at least three generations of peace and stability. The first shock wave was instigated by Afghan communist parties supported by the Soviets, followed by a Soviet invasion occupation that decimated Afghanistan's society, its politics, its political structures, and economic structures, decimated. More than a million Afghans have died, at least. I'm very conservative. A third of the population, more than five and six million Afghans, had to be displaced externally, with millions of others displaced internally. The whole structure, the cadres, the professionals who had been brought up and trained and educated, whether in the East or in the West or domestically, over several generations, either had to leave or were forced to leave or died or were killed or became refugees. So again, when we are talking about today's Afghanistan and what we see in the headlines and what we assume sometimes, we also need to take a look at what used to be and what can again be. I'm not saying that, in a nostalgic manner, I'm not trying to say that we can, recreate the Afghanistan of the 1960s. The world has changed, the region has changed. There are very different dynamics at work. But let me, because of the topic of the day being managing risk and securing interests and problem solving in the Asian century, just spend 1 minute, if I may, before I go back to Afghanistan and our region, if I may, to the concept of the Asian century. I firmly believe that while the 20th century may have been the American century, that I think it's premature to say that the 21st century will be the Asian century or anybody else's century. It may end up being a shared century. We are still, we are still in the process of, I think, determining what kind of century it will be. And this particular decade probably will determine that, because I believe that the 21st century will be dominated to a large extent by countries that excel in innovation, in R&D, and in strategic prowess, adaptability, and foresight. So I think that if you don't have those elements in place, you may look and seem today to be an emerging superpower, but it's not guaranteed. And so we also know that Asia is a very complex, what we call Asia. In our part of the world, of course, Asia starts with Turkey and goes all the way to the Philippines and Malaysia and Indonesia. But Asia is a complex and diverse place. It's a hub for resources, and it's an emerging power, it's an emerging powerhouse, but it's also a place for many unresolved disputes and historic injustices. The issue between Pakistan and Afghanistan, or the issue between Pakistan and India, has to do both with historic injustice and unresolved disputes, to a large extent. Borders drawn during colonial times and beyond, of course, have had an impact and continue to have an impact on today's geopolitics and geoeconomics and today's conflicts. So I look at Asia in that context, and I think that Afghanistan, sort of, some people call it the heart of Asia. Well, heart or kidney or liver, but to the point is that Afghanistan is situated at a sort of a crossroads, as historically it has been. It's a connecting hub But at the same time, unfortunately, it has been a victim of its geography for centuries. And so the Afghans and the people living on this particular real estate have paid dearly over centuries for just being located in this spot. And the 20th century, the end of the 20th century, unfortunately, saw this again as a reoccurrence of great powers. Now, Afghanistan over the last 35 years, and just remember, Afghanistan has been in conflict for almost 35 years. I'm 51 years old. I was 17 when the first coup shots of the communist coup rang 50 meters away from my high school. My high school is situated next to the presidential palace. And so I was a witness to what happened that day and ever since what has happened to Afghanistan. And so I can tell you that there is no Afghan from any ethnic group that doesn't yearn for a peaceful settlement. But they also know that that peaceful settlement has to be just. It has to be durable for it in order for it to be real. And that does not mean at any price. And that does not mean for us to ignore 35 years of sacrifice, bloodletting, and destruction. So from that perspective, Afghanistan over the last 35 years has been at the center of two major Western engagements. Engagements against the West's primary enemies, challengers, if you want to call them. Just imagine that this, one of the poorest countries in the world, one of the least developed countries in the world, over the last 35 years, has been the battleground against the Soviet Union and helped in the collapse of the Soviet system. I'm not saying it was the only factor, but there were others, but it was the last battleground of the Cold War. And the United States and many other countries, including China even, and Saudi Arabia and others, mostly through Pakistan, waged a war on the Afghan battlefield to damage the Soviets. And we all succeeded in doing so. Then, after a period of instability and civil strife and disengagement from Afghanistan, the country fell into the wrong hands, let's say, and it became a victim of, for a while, of regional neighborly interventions and meddling and proxy warfare before it was occupied once more by radicalism and terrorism, another Western foe. And that war again was fought in Afghanistan. Isn't it amazing that two wars against your number one enemy was fought in my country, one of the poorest and one of the least developed? And in the second case, you had to intervene directly. First case, it was the largest covert operation in the history of the world. In the second case, so far, the Americans have lost over 2,000 of your young men and women in a total of 3,500 or so overall NATO forces, almost the equivalent of what was lost on that dreadful day of September 11th, 2001, here in New York, in Washington, in Philadelphia. Tens of thousands of Afghans during this past decade have lost their lives, and many others. In Pakistan, one of our neighbors is on the threshold of maybe chaos. Isn't that one of the titles of your books? Okay. So you have invested heavily over the last decade in trying to deal with this second threat. And you feel that you have achieved your purpose by killing one man and by dismantling to some extent that organization and by targeting some of their other operatives here and there, drones or otherwise. Now, is that the end of a threat called radicalism? And from my country's perspective, it's not. Because it may be the end of one person and it may be the weakening of one organization, but we do not see this phenomena as going away anytime soon. So which means that we have to deal with this phenomena for a long time to come. And this phenomena does not have just a local objective and purpose. It's not just to create an Islamic emirate. It's geared toward a worldview that goes beyond the Islamic countries and nations. And to us, that is what caused sort of an alliance, because the Afghan people had already gone through the subjugation under the Taliban and Al-Qaeda from at least 96 to 2001. And when the US intervened, it was welcomed. It was welcomed because we realized that finally the West and then NATO understood that there is a common threat. Pakistan, under General Musharraf, became a partner in the war on terror, an ally in the war on terror, and many others. And then the United States intervened in such a manner that for the first phase of this intervention, they already claimed victory prematurely and thought that a light footprint was enough to fix Afghanistan's problems and deal with the remaining threats that exist and turned their attention to Iraq. Well, it took them another at least 4 or 5 years to realize that the job in Afghanistan had not been completed, that the light footprint was not sufficient, that NATO needed to get involved and many others needed to get involved, that we needed more resources to engage in some level of state building and nation building. But there was no strategic coherence to this. I've made a list while Ahmed was speaking of what I think were some of the major, you know, sort of higher level weaknesses and shortcomings of this engagement over the last decade. But I also want to stress that I'm not one of those people who believes that all has been negative and that all has been bad or that all is the responsibility and the fault of the United States and NATO. And I will tell you a bit more about that later. But there has been weakness and lack of strategic coherence, both for state building and nation building and vis-a-vis regional dynamics over the last decade. There's been lack of coordination and also prioritization with indigenous forces and indigenous communities. There's been lack of sustainability, something that you touched upon, and durability of the engagement. There's been lack and weakness of good governance on the part of us. You know, Pakistanis have to take responsibility for what they're lacking in, and Afghans have to take responsibility for what is part of their weaknesses. Governance and, of course, capacity. Why is there lack of capacity? People keep talking about lack of capacity. I think I alluded to that at the very beginning by telling you that this country has been decimated. Every class, the professional classes of Afghanistan did not exist anymore. Whatever was built, trained, and educated for over three generations did not exist anymore when I went back in December of 2001 and joined the new government. And it is not possible to recreate that over a 10-year period. It takes at least a generation or so. There's been weakness and lack of transparency and accountability. We all talk about corruption.
all these billions of dollars coming from many different sources, going through different channels, aiming at rebuilding a country in its infrastructure, in its institutions. And at the end of the day, we have a mixed picture and not much to show for. And some of the money was wasted, and the other part of the money was disappeared. But let me also tell you that out of the almost 50 and so billion dollars of non-military aid that has gone to Afghanistan over the last 10 years, 80% at least has gone through non-Afghan channels, through non-Afghan government institutions. It has gone through the international communities, NGOs, UN, embassies, aid agencies, and so on and so forth. So when we talk about contracting, major part of it has gone through contracting and really, at times, shoddy contracting. So when we talk about corruption and unaccountability and lack of accountability and transparency, we really need to be precise about what this means. This is not to justify anything that the Karzai government or those who have swindled billions and those who have, you know, sort of looted banks and others have done. But this is to say that almost everyone engaged is responsible. We also have had weaknesses and lack of good and effective communication at home, in the region, and globally. We have had weaknesses and lack of cultural sensitivity and an appreciation for the history of this region and its people. We see that every day with events that take place, sometimes tragic events that take place, including the green on blue attacks. And so this is a short list of things that really have hampered this mission, this very important mission, probably one of the largest multilateral missions in the last century or so. There are almost 50 nations part of the NATO ISAF contingent in Afghanistan today, and they're starting to pack and leave. There are more than 60 countries and international institutions involved in rebuilding Afghanistan. Almost every major aid agency in the world and major NGO in the world, both on the humanitarian side and development side and all sides that you can think of, are involved in Afghanistan. But this engagement is going to change between now and 2014. And so that brings me to the three issues that Ahmad brought up and the challenges that we face today. We face the challenge of what I call the triple transitions. So we have the security transition that NATO signed on to, the Afghan government signed on to, you know, aiming to pull out almost all of NATO's troops from Afghanistan by the end of 2014. But there is going to be, if things go according to plan, there's going to be a contingent of forces left in Afghanistan beyond 2014. As part of the strategic agreements that have been and are being signed. And there is a part of that agreement with the United States that is being worked on right now about the what they call SOFA, which is the forces, the part that the basing that deals with the basing of US forces beyond 2014 and what under what conditions US forces and for what purposes will be staying in Afghanistan, and in what numbers. But the security part, of course, also has the Afghan component. And the Afghan component of the Afghan National Security Forces, made up of the army and the police, have their problems. But at the same time, they are the only institutions that are carrying the duties of a national institution for security. Today, there was a report put out by NATO, and you can believe it or not, that says that on one hand, 80% of all operations today in Afghanistan are carried out by Afghan forces, and that almost 85% of all casualties are caused by the Taliban, civilian casualties. And NATO feels that Afghan forces will be up to the job. Now, are there issues with the Afghan forces? Of course there are. How many more minutes do I have? We have 3 more minutes. There are problems with the Afghan army, with the Afghan police. There is probably an ethnic balancing problem with it. But they are not problems that should stop us from moving forward. And it doesn't mean that we have to start from scratch again. And it doesn't mean that we have to scrap these programs. What we need to do is improve them and correct them between now and 2014. Now then there's the political process. I think that the political process and the political transition that is going to take place between now and 2014, when Afghan elections, presidential elections, are supposed to be held, are absolutely crucial. But part of it is tied to the, what you call mediation process, the reconciliation process. And part of it has to do with the non-Taliban political process underway in Afghanistan. That non-Taliban political process for transition involves, on one hand, President Karzai and whoever he feels that should replace him, because he has made it quite clear that he is going to endorse someone since his term ends. And then you have the so-called loyal opposition made up of several political groupings and individuals with political stature. There is no single, this is my view, there's no single grouping or individual who can, under today's conditions, rally most of the Afghans and win a contest, an electoral contest. Which means that they would probably have to create a coalition. On the Karzai side, either he has a choice of maybe passing on the baton to one of his family members or to someone that he trusts. The third choice that he may have is, in case conditions worsen, is to call under the Constitution for a state of emergency. The state of emergency could allow him to prolong his term for a while. No one knows what might happen, and no one knows which direction this process will take. But what is essential is that this political, democratic political process has to move forward in Afghanistan, and we need to have a peaceful transfer of power in this country, with or without the Taliban. And by that I mean, between now and 2014, we need to find a way and try all means possible to come to some type of a political arrangement. But I told you my view about political arrangements. They have to have the backing of the Afghan people, all segments of society. They have to be just, felt as being just and durable. Otherwise, I don't think that Afghans or parts of the Afghan society are going to sign on to a deal that is half-cooked or biased or threatens the gains made over the last 10 years. There are some definite red lines. They don't have to be negotiated now. You know, we can talk about the Constitution and amendments to the Constitution at some point during mediation. We can talk about women's rights and girls' rights to go to schools at some point. We can talk about dividing up government posts and giving Taliban a share of government positions, you know. Those are all things that eventually will have to be discussed at some point. But you cannot have a one-sided and lopsided and biased approach by any side. And the United States' role, the international community's role, is to be a facilitator and to be, when possible, a mediator. But the problem is that despite some occasional Taliban announcements and statements, an occasional unknown, unnamed Taliban so-called Quetta Shura representative saying something here and there to some individuals, we really do not have a process with a strategy on behalf of all the main stakeholders. It's very incoherent. There's no strategic alignment. And there is no, at the end of the day, I think that there's very little trust and confidence. And so it's not a serious process yet. And so what would make it and turn it into a serious process is debatable, because I think there are different theories about that. But if the Afghan side, and the Afghan side is, of course, includes the Afghan government and other Afghans who are part of the non-Taliban establishment. If that side feels that it's being sidelined, it's not going to work. If the Taliban cannot introduce a group or a team or a person speaking on their behalf, it's not going to work. If Pakistan is going to play the game of trying to use this process for future strategic gains and gaining leverage, it's not going to be acceptable to the Afghans. And the United States has to be seen as an honest broker in all of this. So, having said this, I don't think that we are even at the beginning of a real reconciliation process yet. There are attempts at jump-starting this, and there are some signals that maybe a process can actually get off the ground. But it's possible that the American elections is one factor, and it's possible that the increase in violence in Afghanistan, especially targeting innocent people and civilians, is another factor. Because it shows that within the Taliban, there are definitely those who do not believe in reconciliation, while there are some who probably do. So everyone's position right now is somewhat hardened by conditions and the situation on the ground. I'm going to stop here because I know that hopefully the people have questions about all of this, but the third transition, of course, is the economic one that you mentioned. You know, Afghanistan is going to lose a huge part of the aid that was coming in. It's going to be reduced, even though in Tokyo a few weeks ago, there was a pledge, not a commitment, a pledge made to provide so many billions until 2016 and then beyond, and a pledge to be mutually accountable. But a lot of that rests on good governance, on the political process, and what happens with the security situation. So we cannot underestimate the economic dimension of this issue. I think it's very important to create a safety net and to make sure that Afghans are not losing hope, because with the loss of hope and increasing pessimism, as we hear occasionally, money is going to flow out of Afghanistan, aid is going to decrease, and Afghans are going to start leaving again. And that would be bad news all around for the country, the neighborhood, and those in the international community who have committed so much over the last decade. Thank you.
Thank you very much. For questions, comments, please do come to the mic, identify yourself, and please go ahead.
U.S. has just designated the Haqqani Network as a terrorist organization. What impact will this have on the SSI and on the Taliban talks? I just don't believe that the Taliban thinks they're going to lose this war. They're just waiting to have the U.S. leave, supposedly in 2014, but we know that there's going to be a force there after that. I just don't see any incentive that the Taliban has to have a reconciliation process. Your opinion, please.
Can go ahead with take three questions, and then the speakers will address them. So please, go ahead.
I'm Paranyan Naziri. I'm an Afghan civilian. And I just came from Afghanistan. I was there in June. People talking to the regular people, they were worried about 2014, thinking as if, you know, it's going to be the end of the world. And they are worried about just basics because they have seen this kind of crisis several times happening in the 90s, break of civil war, and this seems a more complex situation than ever before. So my question is, we look at two issues, listening to both of you. One is there is a crisis, an emergency situation in 2014. There will be a lot of gaps when the U.S. is leaving on political process, on economy, and all of that. And the other is a long-term process to bring durable peace and justice to the country. And I wonder if there is any process going on that first tackles the emergency issue, that in 2014, when there is all the gap, people are not going to start fighting with each other. There will be hunger. There will be a lot of issues immediately. And then second, if there is then a long-term process, a commitment for a durable peace, both from the international community and Afghanistan itself. Thanks.
Thank you, Jonathan Horowitz. I'm with the Open Society Institute, but I also used to work at the U.S. Embassy in Afghanistan. One thing is just the question of, are expectations too high on the mediation and peace process issue? You look at other countries, and often you look at sort of 3 to 5 to 10 years from the earnest beginning of talks before things actually turn into a solid, stable peace process. The other is, and it relates to the issues that was just raised. I mean, what are you hearing? Are people more concerned about a civil war, worst case scenario, civil war unfolding between the Taliban and the Karzai and post-Karzai government? Or are they more concerned about civil wars starting between political power brokers, warlords, of that nature in Kabul in the north and places like that? I'm just curious. And related to that, that has to do with the economy, is what are you hearing about whether Afghans are comfortable keeping their money in the country? You had spoken about, you know, South Africa, you had brain drain and you had the economic flight and things like that. I mean, my sense is that there are a lot of people who just won't invest in Afghanistan because they don't know where stability is going to be in 2014 and the years that follow. Thank you.
Well, you know, in answer to the last speaker and the first speaker, the first questioner, let me just say, I mean, the U.S. has really not prioritized the dialogue with the Taliban as the number one issue. The military continues to run and dictate the policy. The tensions in Washington over this issue of dialogue with the Taliban are self-evident and have been written about extensively, and we all know that they exist. The military has predominated over the State Department in wanting to continue the fight and the war. What logic the military has in trying to say that we'll fight to the last day, to the last breath, to the last, you know, kill as many Taliban as possible, I really don't see the logic of that. And even with the banning of the Haqqanis, you know, it took, unfortunately, there was no recommitment, or there was a very weak recommitment by the administration towards talks. And really, the issue of dialogue, and as I said, the key issue today is ending the war before the Americans leave. That's it. That's what you have to do. And you know, hopefully the rest can sort of, the Afghans will you know, the rest will fall into place. If you can end the war, provide basic security, and allow this army, the new Afghan army, to take control of a peaceful Afghanistan, then there's a good opportunity and chance that the Afghans will do it, will succeed. But if you leave the Afghans in a state of civil war, obviously the chances are reduced enormously. Now, why should the Taliban talk? I mean, look, I really think there are many reasons right now. First of all, the Taliban do not want to fight an extended civil war with the government, and which will be increasingly the non-Pashtuns in the north, who are much better armed now than they ever were, much better organized, supported by almost all the regional states, except for Pakistan. And the danger of a multidimensional civil war where you have the Northerners, the government, the Taliban, factions within the Taliban, all fighting each other is horrendous to the Taliban as well. Secondly, I believe the Taliban know fully well that their attempts at governance in the 90s, as we all know, was hopeless. And they were totally abandoned very quickly by the international community. They know perfectly well that if they were to try and seize power alone or take power, they would once again be abandoned internationally. Afghans would be starving within 6 months. There would be no money, there would be no food, there would be absolutely nothing left in the country. Not to speak of the fact that the neighboring states would all plunge in and do their bit. So I think, thirdly, I think, you know, what we're hearing is the Taliban are fed up with the micromanagement being done by Pakistan and its intelligence services, and they want an end to that. And the only way they can bring that to an end is by having a settlement and going back to Afghanistan. So I think, you know, these are the main reasons. In answer to your question, I mean, I think, you know, I tried to answer that in 2014. The issues you raised are, you know, very pertinent, but it rests on the issues of war and peace. You know, is there going to be a war? Well, obviously, then there will be a huge capital flight, manpower flight. Anybody who can afford it will buy a villa in Dubai, or at least an apartment in Dubai, which is what is happening, in fact, already. We will see a repeat of the Afghans fleeing the Soviet invasion, the Afghans fleeing the Taliban occupation, you know, the seizure of power. We will see it for a third time. A major exodus from the country, and obviously this would be this would mean total failure of what has gone on for the last 12 years. And again, as I say, the war has to be brought to an end. Beyond all other issues, we have to see that Afghanistan is has an element of security and safety before anything else. In answer to your question, I think, you know, there is enormous, a capital flight has started. A lot of people are very hesitant and scared. And I think, as I said earlier, part of the problem is that the U.S. has really not set out any political benchmarks. You know, the U.S., you know, the political, the international community is obsessed with this military transition. it has not really discussed the, you know, the political implications of the pullout and what it is doing to make sure that, you know, elections do take place, that, you know, et cetera, and the whole political framework that we've been discussing. And secondly, of course, there is no regional framework. There's no guarantee for the Afghans. And the Afghans are most scared about this because I think, you know, they have suffered now two or three times consecutively at the hands of their neighbors. And they are really concerned about the neighbors plunging in once again, backing this proxy or that proxy. And again, we see no political direction from the Americans or NATO or the international community. And until, you know, and the Afghans can't set a political direction on this on their own. They need the international community. And if the Americans are not capable of doing it, then they should farm this exercise of forging a regional alliance to someone else, be it the United Nations or some other body. But clearly, we need some kind of regional settlement before 2014.
On the Haqqani group, in relations to talks, you know, the Haqqanis have had a very interesting past, as most of you know, and it's not news that, for example, they have had connections to Al-Qaeda that go back to the 1980s, actually. And over time were institutionalized to a large extent. So they have had a long history and one that, and many chances and many opportunities to actually change that. And they chose not to do so. And the two main linkages that the Haqqanis have, one to Al-Qaeda and the other one to the ISI, is now going to be problematic for Pakistan itself. And so I think the ball is on their court. Some people say, well, it doesn't, you know, it won't make any difference. You know, other groups are on the list and nothing is going to change. But I think that this time around, it's going to, Pakistan has to decide what to do in terms of its traditional reliance on radical groups as proxies. And I think that is a major consideration which will have a major impact overall on security in the region, a major impact on relations with countries in the region, and a major impact on the Afghan reconciliation process. The Afghan reaction to 2014, we all know as an Afghan who also travels to Afghanistan often and we all know that there is anxiety. And anxiety that is fed by bad governance on the part of the Afghan government to begin with. And anxiety about a transition that to them seems a bit hasty and a bit premature. But it's done, so they have to live with the consequences. I think that Afghans still harbor some hope that between now and 2014 we'll be able to find the right formula for both the political transition, the reconciliation, and if we do that, then the economy and the rest will not crumble and collapse. So the effort between now and 2014 the focus has to be on both the reconciliation track to the extent that, again, as I said, as difficult as it is, and on making sure that Afghanistan follows, to the extent possible, again, a credible electoral process. And to reiterate on this reconciliation path, which is another of the questions, I believe that we can't expect this to be only a responsibility of the United States. The United States has an important role to play, but so do the Afghans, and so does Pakistan, maybe to some extent Iran.
and other players in India maybe, and you know, but the main stakeholders in the political reconciliation process are the Afghans, the Taliban, and Pakistan, and the U.S. To some extent, maybe there is some influence that can be used positively, I hope, by Saudi Arabia and some other Arabs to nudge and encourage certain elements within the Taliban to do the right thing. But as long as there is little trust, as long as there's no confidence building measures that are being adopted, and as long as the strategic agenda is not clear and there is no alignment between the different stakeholders in terms of the way defining the way forward, with the U.S. playing again a mediating, an important mediating role, and maybe the UN, which is already, you know, the UN also does its own bit, we are not going to have much happen. And I agree that time is of the essence, and I agree that with this sort of step forward toward 2014, the strategic imperatives are going to keep changing. And the closer we get to 2014, the harder it will be to strike a deal. And the closer we get to 2014, there will be less incentive for some groups to not want to engage, and maybe for others to want to engage even more. I think that, again, I think that the American elections in November will probably be, once done and over with, can allow the United States to refocus on this reconciliation process.
Next three and the last three questions,
please. I'm Ajmal, I'm from Afghanistan. I work at the Ministry of Finance at the Aid Management Directorate. And actually, from both of what you implied, I could see that the Western world, or especially the US and the UK, have established a system in Afghanistan or else places that they have been that will utterly collapse without them being there. And this actually makes us to feel that 2014 is like a doomsday. But as President Karzai has also reflected on many of his speeches, that not everything is about 2014, it's 2014 and beyond, which is the transition and transformation decade. And sort of a comment that from the scholarly publications that I've read from viewers, that in post-war communities or societies, it's too difficult to reconstruct or to rehabilitate them, and where to start. And as I've heard from many people working in Afghanistan, the problem that existed there, it was that there was too much money in the beginning, and there were too many actors involved with different policies and different directions. And I think that made it very difficult. And the question is that if we are left after 2014 with only few actors, let's say the US or the UK, and when we have a very aligned strategies and policies of these donors with the country and a holistic approach, would that help Afghanistan or not? How optimistic are you of the future of Afghanistan? And that's actually the question I want to ask. And that's it, I think. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Chris Rogers with Open Society. My first question is back on this issue of reconciliation or mediation. And I mean, I guess I agree, as was mentioned, that the Taliban in the longer term have incentives, to agree in power sharing or to be part of the government, et cetera. But I guess the question is, in the medium term or the shorter term, between now and 2014, the incentives seem to be aligned very much in the opposite direction. With every passing day, certainly elements of the Taliban will be able to convincingly argue that their hand will increase, that their power in a bargaining context will increase coming up to 2014. So I guess I wonder whether or not, given that, and then given other structural, really structural elements of between now and 2014, the uncertainty amongst the players that will pervade until that point, until people understand what the game will look like going forward, means that a deal of any real sort isn't possible between now and then. And if that's true, then what do you do strategically from the U.S. or Afghan perspective, if one agrees with that assessment? And secondly, as has been mentioned, it does seem that the U.S. position is sort of in limbo until the elections. Nothing new is going to happen, and no new emergent ideas are going to come about until after November. But hopefully, after the election, once the dust settles from that, there is a moment of rebooting. Let's say you have, you know, a second term with Obama or a new administration. But either way, there will be a moment in which people can start to rethink what the United States should do going forward as we come into 2014. So I guess I wonder, in that moment, whether it be the day after the election or come January, what do you think that, especially outside groups like ours, should be pressing the United States to do? How can we help that process for them to realign their thinking in the most productive way going forward?
I am Ramakrishna from Nepal. I'm a columnist, writer, and a media manager there. I have a few things to tell here. I sometimes visit Pakistan, Afghanistan in few jobs. What I personally feel that the main solution of all those this conflict mitigation is the employment, skill development, or quality education, which we fail to do. Sometimes we also talk about conflict mitigation in Nepal also. In Nepal also, sometimes we all discuss about Afghanistanization, Iraqization, even Pakistanization. We talk about that. But the main solution, which is the joining hand and mouth of the poor people, that we never consider. We make a discourse, we talk more, among we all elite people who have very good access nationally and internationally. We become the ministers, we become the ambassadors, and we talk, we have always a kind of access, and we have access in talking for the conflict and even peace process. And we personally, we are not committed for the country because our children do not study there, our family do not live there, and we have a lot of money to do here and there.
If you could get to the question, or
this is what maybe this is this may be the one of the reason, perhaps this is what I would like to put as a question to them. And the next is even we don't have maybe whether we have any target for the donation recipient, as a donation recipient country, whether we get any target to mitigate the conflict or not.
Let me just answer the first earlier question about the Haqqanis. The Haqqanis have never claimed to be separate from the Taliban. They have always said that they are part of the Taliban, and that any negotiations that will be done between the Americans and the Taliban will be done by Mullah Omar and what we call the Quetta Shura, they believe in Mullah Omar, etc. So obviously, I think the designation of the Haqqanis as a terrorist group is going to be even more detrimental to the talks. To the talks process. Now, the real tragedy to my mind is that the talks have been suspended since March, I think. And they're probably not going to be resumed in a great hurry. We're probably looking at a whole year. And the question, you asked, about this whole process, is that I fear now very much that the failure of the U.S. to prioritize the talks has sent a very definite signal to Pakistan, Iran, and perhaps some of the other neighbors too, that the U.S. is really not serious about a negotiation with the Taliban. And that we keep our powder dry till 2014, meaning we, Pakistan, Iran, other neighboring states, and we make our move once the Americans leave. And we make our move in the traditional way through Afghan proxies. that we have developed over the years, whether it's the, you know, whatever. And so really, I fear the failure of the U.S. to push for Tor. I don't see the next U.S. administration after March convincing the U.S. military and the CIA and all the other parts of the U.S. government that talk should be prioritized above and beyond the bombing and killing of more and more Taliban. And of course, the killing of more Taliban is not going to resolve the issue. There's a huge backlog of fighters, etc., that can come forward. I think, you know, you raised a very important point, and I think that has a lot to do with the first thing I said, that really, you know, there's been a failure of creating institutions of governance. The fact is that, you know, the ministries in Kabul are no more capable today of running their ministries, having development programs and funding and paying salaries on time and doing all that effectively as they were even perhaps 10 years ago. There's corruption, there's incompetence, and even though there's been a lot of training of civil servants and all, there really has not been that kind of coordination. And the model of AID and DFID, you know, sending out their experts and putting them in the ministries and paying them huge salaries, when these so-called experts don't have any knowledge about Afghanistan or very limited cultural knowledge, very limited knowledge about how the methods of governance can be introduced in Afghanistan, we are left with this real problem of a lack of governance. And the Afghans themselves have not addressed it. President Karzai has not addressed this issue. Of course, we all know that, you know, I fear again that what is going to happen after 2014 is a Fortress Kabul strategy, which was pursued by Najibullah after the Soviets left in 1989. That is, you secure five or six cities, you concentrate your security forces there, you let the countryside fall into the hands of, you know, whoever it is, the Taliban, warlords, whatever, you try and secure the roads between the cities, but eventually the roads fall also into the hands of the opposition. And, you know, I fear that something like that will happen, and the lack of governance in the countryside will be that we have today will only get worse. Basically my summation is that if talks do not progress and if we do not see a proper dialogue, which of course brings in both the northerners, the Pashtuns, the government, and the Taliban, unless we see this process take place, we are going to see a very rapid deterioration and the interference of the neighbors in 2014.
On the first question of too much money, too many actors, you know, we've been going through phases over the last 11 years. I was part of the first few international conferences, donor conferences, Tokyo, Berlin, and so on. You know, for the first 5 or 6 years, there wasn't too much money. You know, in Tokyo 2002, the first ever donors conference, the international community committed $5 billion over a 3 to 4 year period, which is, you know, very little for a country that was absolutely, totally destroyed. There was no prioritization. I remember before going to Tokyo and even Berlin in 2004, there was no talk of agriculture being a priority, a country where 80% of the people live and work on the land. There was no talk of electricity and power generation in a country that badly needs it, in a country that has hydroelectric capacity. There was no talk of institution and capacity building to that extent in a country that didn't have it anymore and that needed it so badly, and so on and so forth. It took the international community at least 6 to 7 years, and the Afghans, who had to be the ones who had to put that on the table, to realize that we needed a strategy. We needed priorities.
And then they started to increase the amounts. It was a bit too late. By then, the insurgency had restarted by 2005. The country was now refocused on, you know, what the Taliban were doing in the countryside. And how on earth did they come back? From where did they come back? We thought they were defeated. For many years, Karzai and others went around saying, it's gone, they're finished, don't worry about them. You know, let's focus on other things. I was there. I mean, I was part of all these discussions. So when we told General Musharraf on several occasions, on numerous occasions, brother, as he called them, we have evidence that you have sanctuaries. We have evidence that you are sheltering this guy. We even gave him addresses, phone numbers. And he would just dismiss it offhand, saying, utter nonsense, you know, they're not here. The same way that he said that Bin Laden is not here. Okay, so these are realities that we as Afghans have to deal with on a daily basis. And today, then the time came when everybody started to shift towards how to find a political solution to this long war. And that now has become the longest war in American history. And so there is goodwill on the part of, I'm sure, all Afghans to come to terms with their Afghan Taliban brethren. But we don't really know what they want. Yes, they can, you know, give you a little piece of here and a little piece of this. And we don't know what exactly Pakistan wants. Pakistan has not come out with a clear set of demands, let alone strategy. And the Afghan side, whether it's Karzai's government or people outside of government, whether it's parliament, whether it's civil society, whether it's traditional society, whether it's Pashtun, whether it's Hazara, whether it's Tajik, whether it's Uzbek, whatever it is, they do want peace, and they do want some type of end to this bloodletting. But they will not accept it as a submission to radicalism, a return to the 1990s, a subjugation to a neighboring country, or the dismantlement of the gains and the loss of the gains made for women and girls and men and rights, as fragile and as infantile as they may be. They consider that as hard-earned, and they want to maintain that. I'm not saying that the Constitution does not need amending, and our Taliban brothers can come and sit down and tell us how they want to amend it, but they haven't done that yet. We don't know what they want. They say, oh yeah, we can talk about they say we want a ceasefire first. Then we'll talk about announcing whether we are breaking up with Al-Qaeda. To me, that seems a bit fishy. Ceasefire first, then you're going to tell us whether you're going to cut your ties to Al-Qaeda? So, again, it's not just the U.S. that has to carry all the weight or is responsible for everything. Other players are equally responsible. The Taliban have responsibility, and knowing that the Taliban are not as cohesive and united in this as some people think they are, Pakistan's government needs to make it clear, is it going to continue to use radicalism and extremism and such groups as foreign policy and security policy assets? It has to decide. Pakistan has to decide for its own sake and for the region's sake and for global security's sake. Afghans are not anti-Pakistani. We have had our issues over the years. But we have made it clear over the last 10 years that we want to live as good neighbors. We can do so much good for our economies, for our young, for our youth, for social and social and economic development. We know you have a problem with India. We know that Iran has a problem with the US and the West. But you can't fight it at the expense of Afghanistan. But if that's what you call realpolitik, if that's what it takes, then Afghans will have to do what they think is right for them. And that means not agreeing to anything that seems fishy.
That leaves me with the very nice job of thanking everyone, especially the speakers, for their very enlightening views today. I think it's become very clear that maybe not just about Afghanistan and reconciliation, but on the whole thing of looking at the entire issue of how some of these countries are going through the transitions, that a lot of new thinking is needed in terms of what are the right ways and conceptual frameworks for even conceptualizing how the transitions are going to work out and what the key elements should be, both domestically and internationally. And unless that thinking happens, and unless we move away from thinking just about military aid and diplomacy in its current form, it's very hard to see how some of these transitions can happen to a sustainable economy or a sustainable society. Thank you very much, all of you, for coming.
Thank you.